From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The Titans are undefeated, which would come as no surprise to Homer or to Apollonius of Rhodes. Ahead on Only a Game, what do Tennesseans think about their 8-0 NFL team? Also, Pat Forty previews the men's college basketball season, and author Dave Fromm discusses his season in Prague as a semi-pro basketball player. Also ahead, after a 75-year absence, cricket returns to a Boston-area cricket club.
I'll be very upset if I see any legs before wickets. I told Peggy, avert your eyes if you see any leg before wicket.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Saints are mediocre. Is it blasphemy to say it? The Kansas City Chiefs are in a huddle now to pray it will snow so hard this weekend that their game will be snowed out. The Bengals likely feel the same, and no one now can doubt that all the Lions in Detroit are feeling not so great, for they've not won a single game, and they are 0-8. But enough about some of the teams that wish the season was over instead of only half over. Joining me now on the line to talk about the NFL at midseason is Alex Marvez of FoxSports.com. Alex, welcome to Only a Game.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's start with the NFC East. It's the only division that does not contain a team at or below 500. Maybe the commissioner should bend the rules a little bit so that New York, Washington, Philadelphia, and Dallas fight it out in a kind of round-robin tournament to see who gets to the Super Bowl. What do you think?
I'm so with you on that. Not only that, about 4 weeks ago I said what Roger Goodell needs to do is go ahead and make a trade. He needs to trade a team from the NFC West to the NFC East to go ahead and try to balance this thing out, because you're right. It just really isn't fair. You're going to look at a good team that's going to be left out of the postseason simply because that division is absolutely stacked. And it is pretty remarkable when you think about it. The Dallas Cowboys, a team that so many of us, including myself, had predicted would reach the Super Bowl, have just completely faded, gone into the middle of the pack at 5-4. And even they're better than the dregs of the NFC West. But you got to love it if you're an NFC East fan. You got Giants, Redskins, and Eagles fighting it out to win that top spot.
I know football fans are terrifically resilient, but I just can't imagine what their response would be if the commissioner were to announce a mid-season trade like that.
Hey, I would love to see it. You know, another thing, too, we might just see the abolishment altogether of divisions down the road. If the NFL ends up going to 34 teams, which a lot of us suspect that they will at some point, maybe with an expansion franchise in Los Angeles and maybe one in London, maybe we'll go ahead and just get two giant columns, one column of AFC teams, one column of NFC teams, 18-game schedule. Maybe everyone plays each other once would be sort of intriguing.
Some people saw the New York Giants Super Bowl season last season as a little bit fluky, but they're 7-1 this year. Does that give the lie to the argument that last season was a fluke?
I think that we've all sort of got to dismiss that thought from our heads that last season was a fluke. This was a team that began surging. They just started surging late. And where I think you have to give them credit is that they learned from some of the lessons of last year. They've kept that confidence going. You know, Eli Manning has improved as a quarterback. These defensive players, Justin Tuck, Matias Kiwanuka, defensive end, they've gone ahead and replaced Michael Strahan and Osu Yumanura in a great way. They are 7-1. They are on an absolute roll right now. To me, the best team in football, even though the Tennessee Titans have a slightly better record, I think the Giants are the team to beat in the NFL.
And I think it's always more fun to talk about a really bad team than it is to talk about a good team. So let's discuss the 0-8 Lions. What, if anything, can Detroit do this year to stave off complete disaster?
Bring back Bobby Lane.
He would be, what, 70-some now?
Unfortunately, he has passed away.
See, but it's too late.
You know, it is a little too late, but I tell you, it may be the alternative they have under center right now. Really, this is a Detroit Lions team without a quarterback since 1957, and it continues right now. And I tell you, this Lions team legitimately has a shot of going 0-16. I look at their schedule. It is not an easy one moving forward. I think this team may become the first in league history to do the offer.
The San Francisco 49ers promoted Mike Singletary to head coach in the hope that his disciplinarian's approach would help save the Niners' season. The team responded to his benching of Vernon Davis and to his dropping his pants at halftime 2 weekends ago by losing that game. After their bye week, where does this love story go?
It goes badly. Trust me, and I don't think Mike Singletary, he could get naked. It's not going to make a difference in that San Francisco locker room. They just are devoid of talent, you know, to be honest. And that you have to put that on Mike Nolan, the former former head coach. You know, when he took over in 2005, he was supposed to retool this squad, and instead it just went from bad to worse. And really across the board, it's hard to find very many strengths with this 49ers team. I think the losing continues onward, and I don't know if Mike Singletary is able to keep that job. To be quite honest, I think the 49ers end up going in a different direction in the offseason.
In the AFC East, there's quite a pileup at the top, unless it's a pileup at the bottom. I'm not sure which. But the Pats, the Jets, the Bills, and the Dolphins, we assume one team or more will create some separation, as they say in NFL circles these days. Which teams end up at the top and which at the bottom?
I'm going with the Jets, and I know that's against my better judgment because it just seems like Bill Belichick has Eric Mangini's number every time they play, but I think the Jets are a team that's surging right now. And yeah, Brett Favre hasn't done it in a pretty fashion. He's the gunslinger Brett Favre. He's going to throw as many touchdowns as interceptions sometimes. He'll make you throw your hands up in your head sometimes in frustration, sometimes cheering him on, but I think the Jets end up winning this division. We're going to know a lot more about this Jets squad November 13th when they play at New England, and then the week after that at Tennessee. If they're able to split those games, go 1-1, I give them a real good shot at winning this thing.
The Oakland Raiders waived highly paid cornerback D'Angelo Hall on Wednesday. Team officials have said they haven't given up on the season, but should we expect to see a gaggle of Raiders showing up in Al Davis's driveway with a big yard sale sign out in front on the lawn?
You know, it's a shame for the Raiders that the trade deadline isn't later in the season, because I'm sure they'd be trying to spin off talent right now, but instead they're releasing players, D'Angelo Hall the first. This mistake cost the Raiders $8 million. It cost them a second-round draft pick and another embarrassment for a franchise that has had plenty this season.
At this stage of the season, Alex, midway to be precise, it would appear that Pittsburgh, which is 6-2, and Tennessee, which is 8-0, would be serious Super Bowl contenders. Have I got that right?
Yeah, you have it absolutely right, and I cannot wait until those two teams meet on December 21st, because that game, you're going to be able to hear the collisions from anywhere in the country. They're going to be hitting so hard. You know, Tennessee plays the type of football that wins games in January. You know, they run the football, and they play outstanding defense. They don't make a lot of mistakes. They right now lead the league in the turnover ratio. They're plus 10. Kerry Collins does a fabulous job taking care of the football. I mean, I think they're going to be around toward the end. I'm not so sold on the Pittsburgh Steelers simply because they have a championship caliber defense, but the problem is they can't keep Ben Roethlisberger healthy. This quarterback of theirs is just taking an absolute beating behind a very porous offensive line. I think that the Steelers, as the season goes on, may get more and more banged up, and I just have that sneaking suspicion that unfortunately for a great defense, that offense isn't going to be good enough to put them in the big game.
Alex Marvez covers the NFL, among other things, for FoxSports.com. Alex, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Hey, thanks. Anytime.
The aforementioned Titans are the only team undefeated at the midpoint of the 2008 NFL season. As Only a Game's Ron Schachter reports from Nashville, there may be more than smoke and mirrors at work.
At the tailgate parties before Tennessee's home game against the Green Bay Packers last Sunday, there was no shortage of good food on the picnic tables, and plenty of optimism from fans like Joella Boy.
I am so excited that they're undefeated. It's great, and I've been a fan all these years ever since they've come here, and this is like a best year for them.
You like ham?
A little bit, yeah.
Try that. It's good. I've got another one if you want one, too.
Jim Clark has been a season ticket holder since the team moved here from Houston almost a decade ago. Besides sharing his culinary specialty, he offered up a brief Titans history.
After we went to the Super Bowl in 99, the next year in 2000, we probably had the best team in the NFL, and then we ended up slipping up here with home field advantage. And then we had the salary cap issues, and we had to dump all our good players. And since then, we've been slowly rebuilding. So I think for most Titans fans, we thought we would be good. I don't know that we thought we'd be 7-0, but I think that most of us thought that we would be extremely good this year. I don't think this is a surprise to a lot of Titans fans.
While a military flyover provided some of the pregame entertainment inside LP Field, what's attracted more attention this season is the home team's 8-0 record, thanks in part to their overtime win Sunday against the Packers. That feat gave them a luxurious four-game cushion over the Indianapolis Colts, their closest rival in the AFC South. The 2008 Titans have reached these heights despite some high drama during and after their opening game, centered around third-year quarterback Vince Young, who led Tennessee to a playoff berth last year. Jim Wyatt covers the team for the Nashville Tennessean.
He was struggling. I mean, and the home crowd was booing him. He'd thrown two interceptions. Vince was reluctant, did not want to go back in the game at first, and had the appearance that he had kind of given up on his team and given up on his head coach. The criticism that he got from that led him to a situation where, you know, he disappeared for a couple hours a day after the opening win. Jeff Fisher had to call police to look for him.
Fisher, the Titans' head coach, subsequently installed 14-year veteran Kerry Collins, who had backed up Young for the past 2 years as the permanent starter. Collins' passing numbers since then haven't been that impressive. About 1,200 yards, just 3 touchdowns, and an overall rating that puts him well down the list of NFL quarterbacks. But Collins also has tossed just 3 interceptions and managed the offense efficiently. He says that gaudy statistics aren't the keys to the team's first half success.
I think one thing we're doing well is we're not turning the ball over. I think that has a lot to do with it. And also, obviously, the running game, offensive line. I think our receivers are making timely plays, you know. I think I've made timely plays, but it hasn't been pretty the whole way. Obviously, our defense keeps us in every game.
That defense, built around the veteran trio of outside linebacker Keith Bullock, defensive end Javon Kearse, and tackle Albert Haynesworth, has held opponents to a league-low 13 points a game. With Haynesworth's inside presence so dominating that he's considered a candidate for league MVP. And the Titans have even gotten a big assist from kicker Rob Baronis, who nailed 4 field goals last Sunday, including the overtime game winner. The Tennessean's Wyatt says nobody here is making comparisons with the undefeated Miami Dolphins and their substitute quarterback Earl Morrill, who led the Finns to a Super Bowl title in 1972. Or, for that matter, with the only other NFL team to go undefeated in the regular season.
They're not going to remind anybody of the Patriots from last season that went undefeated through the regular season. Well, this team's won games ugly. They've won by playing good defense. But I certainly think they're going to put themselves in position to have home field advantage throughout the playoffs. And the way this team has been playing at home, certainly that could put them in position to get to the Super Bowl again, which would be the first time since the team first moved to Nashville and began playing at the Coliseum in 99.
Sunday's win over the Packers marked the Titans' 100th straight sellout at home. And with tens of thousands on the waiting list for season tickets, there's plenty of local interest. But current season ticket holder Joella Boyd would like to see more national attention for the Titans, considering what they've accomplished, including home field victories against Indianapolis, Jacksonville, and Green Bay, which until last Sunday had led the NFC's North Division.
I think we've played some really good teams. I do have to say ESPN, I don't think, says enough about the Titans. You know, when the Patriots were undefeated, it was all on everything, and they're just not giving the Titans any credit. I don't like that. We don't get respect at all.
Titans critics point to the combined losing record of their opponents so far and warn that the rest of the season will include away games at the Colts and Jaguars and a late December matchup at home against the Pittsburgh Steelers, currently 6-2. Tennessee's second-half test begins tomorrow afternoon when they visit Chicago to play the 5-3 Bears. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in Nashville.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. On Monday, a female jogger in Yavapai County, Arizona, learned that pulled muscles, turned ankles, and dehydration weren't the only things she had to worry about while exercising. The woman was attacked by a rabid fox about a mile short of her destination. The fox first bit her foot, then when the jogger grabbed the fox by the neck, he went for her leg and, having missed, bit her arm. The jogger ran another mile to her car with the fox still attached, then pried the animal off, tossed it into the trunk of her car, and drove to Prescott Hospital, where the woman received a rabies shot and the fox bit an animal control officer who wasn't even jogging. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, cricket makes an unexpected return to a cricket club. Will wonders never cease? But first, Halloween's over. Must be almost time for college basketball and the pursuit of March glory. So we'll talk to ESPN's Pat Forty. He joins me now for a season preview. Pat, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. North Carolina made it to the Final Four last season, then they got pounded by Kansas in the semifinal matchup. Tar Heels have a star forward and preseason All-America pick in Tyler Hansborough. He's back, of course. Will they be able to get over the top to the championship this time around?
If they can't, there's going to be some splaining to do to the North Carolina fans, because the Tar Heels are loaded, and I have never seen a team that is a bigger favorite on paper than North Carolina. I mean, they're unanimous in every poll. I can't find anybody out there willing to stick their neck out even a little and pick anybody else.
After Kansas beat North Carolina, they went on to win the national title. The Jayhawks shaping up pretty well this year?
Well, you know, they did have some major losses. Obviously, Mario Chalmers, Darrell Arthur, Darnell Jackson have all checked out. And I think there's a little bit of a changing of the guard in the Big 12. Kansas is certainly still going to be in the mix. They're going to be a top 25 team, probably top 15. But I don't see them competing for the national title. Oklahoma looks like the team perhaps to beat in the Big 12, and maybe Texas as well.
Connecticut was upset by the University of San Diego in round one of the 2008 tournament, but Jim Calhoun's Huskies are ranked second in the current preseason poll. Is this a reasonable place for them to be?
I think so. I'm sure that Coach Calhoun would say it's unreasonable at this point, but somebody has to be ranked that high. And that's the interesting thing, is trying to figure out who really should be number two behind North Carolina. Is it, you know, Louisville or UConn or any of five other teams or so from the Big East? That conference is just going to be a beast. Or, you know, is it Duke? Is it Michigan State? I'm not sure where we turn for second best.
Well, you mentioned Louisville, which is ranked number three preseason. I keep looking down the list and can't find Kentucky, though.
Yeah. You're right, and that is an unusual thing when you put together a top 25 and Kentucky's not in it to start a season. Kentucky is still in transition mode from Tubby Smith to Billy Gillespie. They've got two very good players, Patrick Patterson and Jody Meeks, and then they've got a bunch of other guys to go with them. And it's going to be, I think we're going to have to find out how good the other guys are. There are 19 players on Kentucky's roster, Bill, if you count the armada of walk-ons that Billy Gillespie has brought in. And I think he's hoping just the sheer force of numbers, maybe he'll find some other guys and throw a team out there.
Indiana is hoping to restore its clean image and winning ways after some recruiting violations and a meltdown late last season following the departure of head coach Kelvin Sampson. How long will it be before new coach Tom Crean can turn things around for the Hoosiers?
Oh, it'll be a while, Bill, no doubt about that. They should be bad this year, flat out bad. This could be the worst Indiana team in decades, if not ever. If they win 10 games, I think Tom Crean could be Big Ten Coach of the Year. They have nobody back. Their leading scorer from last year averaged 1.2 points per game. They do have a little bit of talent, but it's all scary young talent. Tom Crean will get it going. He's a great coach. He's already recruiting very well for the future, but this is going to be a grit your teeth kind of year for Indiana fans who are used to much better. They just, if there's the expectation bar should be set at, are we trying hard, yes or no?
Scary young talent would be a great thing to put on the preseason promotional material, though, don't you think?
Absolutely.
Come see the scary young talent. Turning to the West Coast, UCLA has reached the last three Final Fours but left each year without a championship. What about the Bruins? Do they have what it takes this time around?
You know, they're probably right back where they have been, which is not a bad place if you can win 30 games and go to the Final Four. The problem is, you know, they've gotten to the Final Four and really kind of been torn apart the last few years. You know, it was Florida for a couple of years. It was Memphis last year. And what we've seen is they're just not quite as athletic as some of the other teams. They lost Russell Westbrook, their best athlete, to the NBA. They lost Kevin Love to the NBA. Darren Collison is back. He's a good point guard, but I don't know whether he's an elite point guard. They did recruit extremely well. They have a freshman who's going to be fun to watch named Drew Holiday, and they're going to be very good again. I just don't know whether they're any better than they were the last couple of years, and that wasn't good enough to win a title.
UCLA's crosstown rivals, the Trojans of Southern California, are being projected as a top 25 team in the preseason polls after they missed the tournament completely last spring. High expectations legitimate there?
You know, I'm kind of wait and see there. I think that, you know, they lost O.J. Mayo, and he was such a dominant personality on that team, it may actually be a little bit of addition by subtraction just from the standpoint that some other guys may be able to step up and flourish a bit more. You know, Tim Floyd's brought that program a long way in a short while, but you know, I still think that they are a couple of steps below competing for any sort of national title.
All right, Pat, I'm assuming that based on what we've already said, you see North Carolina in the Final Four again in March. You're not going to depart from the experts too much on that score, I would think. Who else is there?
Oh, if I had to guess, I'll take two from the Big East. I think that league's going to be that good. And right now I would take Connecticut and Louisville. I think those are the two best teams there. And I kind of like Duke. You know, I know that they have kind of been a bit exposed in previous NCAA tournaments for lacking a little bit of athleticism themselves and maybe just being a little bit soft. But I think these guys are gotten, their core group has gotten older, presumably gotten better. They add a couple more good recruits. I think Mike Krzyzewski may be a better coach for having gone through the Olympics and maybe just learned a few additional things about how to deal with his players. Not that he needed a whole lot to learn.
I love college basketball discussions because somebody always says these 21 and 22-year-olds are getting older. I love that kind of talk.
Yeah. Doesn't make us feel too old, does it?
Pat Forte covers college basketball and a variety of other sports for ESPN. Pat, thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you. Enjoy the season, Bill.
If you pine for plentiful podcasts, please visit onlyagame.org and click on podcast. What's in a name? Or maybe the question should be, what's not in a name? Until recently, the last time anyone had seen an over of cricket at Boston's Longwood Cricket Club, FDR had just been elected president. But last month, club groundskeepers plucked posts and tennis nets from the crew-cut lawn to stage the first Longwood cricket match in 75 years. Only a Game's Ken Shulman was there and had himself, well, a wicket good time.
They do get extra. You get 6 points if you hit it out of the pitch.
It's a funny game, that cricket, at least to American eyes. The stiff-armed bowling, the stiff-lipped etiquette, the white-clad players on the broad green lawn, as if a group of extras from An Officer and a Gentleman were moonlighting as models for Monet. And then there's all those rules.
I'll be very upset if I see any legs before wickets. I told Peggy, avert your eyes if you see any leg before wicket.
Jeff Peters and his wife Peggy, a Longwood member, are two of the 75 faithful, fanciful, and merely curious folk packing the clubhouse porch as Rhode Island's St. Columba team takes on a side of Oxford and Cambridge University alumni. I ask him if he knows anything about the game.
I was pretending to just a minute ago. I think I know a little. I mean, I think I will know what they're trying to do to each other. I know what the bowler is trying to do. He's trying to knock those wickets over, the bales off the wickets, and the hitter is trying to keep that from happening, trying not to hit it in the air so they can catch it.
It's a chilly afternoon. Even for October, flashes of red and yellow maple fringe the broad green lawn as cricketers in V-neck sweaters play pepper. Few, if any, have ever played on a field as smooth as this one. Neil Malcolm is a philosopher and captain of the Oxford-Cambridge side.
I heard about Longwood Cricket Club many years ago, and I was always intrigued by the name. I looked up a bit of the history, and I found out the last cricket match played here was in 1933, which is also a time of global financial disaster. 75 years ago. So looking for historical parallels, I thought, why can't we come play cricket again?
Given that we're in a time of global
exactly.
financial disaster.
This may help turn things around.
Wow. 10 points.
Founded in 1877 in what's now Boston's medical area, Longwood Cricket Club soon succumbed to the allure of lawn tennis. The clubhouse pictures tell the story. Images of the first Davis Cup match, of the 13 Longwood members who won national titles, of the many tennis greats who played tournaments here. The lone cricket pick hangs in the rec room, where a few members take a break from cricket and cold to watch women's tennis on TV. Longwood's last cricket match was a 1933 benefit for a groundskeeper retiring after 48 years of service. So why now? Michelle Scheinman is president of Longwood.
One of our members is affiliated with the Society of Oxford Cambridge and is friendly with Neil Malcolm. And I think one day they were here looking out of the courts, and one said to the other, "Are you thinking what I'm thinking?" And they said, "Yes, I am. Wouldn't it be nice to have a cricket match here?"
Cricket's homecoming here reads more like a poster for Benetton than a page from Brideshead Revisited. Immigrants from India, Pakistan, Trinidad, and Ireland bat and bowl on a pitch once reserved for ladies and gentlemen of means and breeding. The symbolism isn't lost on Scheinman, himself the son of European Jewish immigrants.
Clearly, cricket, back when it was played 100 years ago, was not a game for the masses. It was for the leisure classes, as was tennis. I and my family certainly would not have been invited, I think might be the nice word, to participate or assist, either as a visitor to this match and certainly not as a club member.
It's like all things practice. It can hurt. The idea is to sort of draw it into your body so you slow the ball down kind of slowly. Otherwise it does sting.
Back on the porch, spectators shiver and try to make sense of the action, or lack of it. Some wonder whether a batter could drive the ball into the grandstand for 6 runs. Member Mark Turner admits that cricket, much like baseball, can be achingly boring to those who have never played it, but fascinating to those who have.
And as you get to watch more cricket, you'll learn more of the nuances in terms of the different strokes that the batsmen play. Obviously, unlike baseball, where you basically slog it as hard as you can forwards, it's very easy and very effective to use the speed of the ball to turn it around and hit it actually behind the wicket as well. And that's a slog to work. Whoa! That's 6 runs. You see, now in baseball, they wouldn't have thrown it back, would they? They'd have kept it as a souvenir.
Good shot!
If watching today's match is a window onto Longwood's past, playing it is a portal to the players' hearts. Here, on a pitch thousands of miles from their homelands, cricketers chat in Urdu and Tamil and Afrikaans as they reconnect with the game they were taught around the time they learned to walk. Chris Schultz is from South Africa.
There's a certain level of sport being in your blood. It's who you are. Cricket is in our blood, man. We're not here because we can play. We're here because we just love the game. You know, we're in love with the game.
Classic cricket can go on for days. The organizers of this match wisely chose the one-day version. By the final over, Oxford-Cambridge draws close enough to save face, losing 180 runs to 140. With daylight fading and most of the crowd gone home, Neil Malcolm lines his side up for a team photo. No one seems to care about the score, or the cold, or the global financial meltdown. The suburban tennis club, by any other name, smells just as sweet, like a slice of home.
It went very well. It was a wonderfully sporting occasion. Great fun was had by everyone under superb conditions at Longwood. And if I could bottle this and keep it, I would. I'd sell it too.
For Only a Game, I'm Ken Schulman in Brookline, Massachusetts.
But who cares a button for that when he's in and bangs a succession of forwards? All things there's rough and there's smooth to be found, and if rough should prevail, one must wear it. But this won't mar the fun of the gay cricket ground with some jolly good fellows to share it. But this won't mar the fun of the gay cricket ground with some jolly good fellows to share.
You're listening to Only a Game. What happens when you run a story about one of the teams in the World Series on your radio show is that fans of the other team give you a hard time, or at least that's what happens if you are me. Mark Purdy, who hears only a game on WITF in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, was outraged when, on our October 25th show, reporter Bobby O'Brien referred to fans of the Tampa Bay Rays as, quote, long-suffering, even though the Rays finished last in 9 of the 10 seasons preceding 2008. The real story is Philadelphia, Mr. Purdy wrote. 28 years without a World Series champ, 25 years without a championship in any sport, and loyal fans who grew up with the team. You missed the story, and I can't help thinking that with the Red Sox and Cubs out, you can't even get the bat off your shoulder. Peter Lewis, another WITF listener, was similarly unhappy. In his email, he celebrated the virtues of Phil's manager Charlie Manuel, as well as several of his favorite players. He ended his email as follows: win or lose, I hope you can appropriately toast the Phillies on next week's show. Mr. Lewis, I hope you were listening at the beginning of last week's program when we did just that and heard from lots of celebrating Philadelphia fans as well. Support for Equal Time for the Phillies came from well outside Pennsylvania, too. Jeff Weber, who hears only a game on Tri-States Public Radio in Western Illinois, closed his email by writing, "The only thing you'll probably mention about the Philadelphia fans is that they snowballed Santa Claus 40 years ago." Mr. Weber, I wasn't going to mention that revealing incident, but I'm glad you did. Finally, in response to Karen Givens' story on last week's program, Kathy Perlick, who hears only a game on WVGN, National Public Radio for the Virgin Islands, wrote as follows: only a game is my very favorite sports show. I especially loved the zombie tag story. Where else would this sport get coverage? But who was singing that song at the end of the segment that ended with the refrain, "I walked with zombies"? That would be Rocky Erickson, and the title of the song is "I Walked with a Zombie." Just one, less scary, I guess. We welcome your questions and comments. You can reach us via our website, onlyagame.org. Our mailing address is onlyagame, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Reside, providing vintage home accessories, lighting, and furnishings by 20th century classic modern designers. Collections on view at resideinc.com. And Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In several cities across the U.S., bicyclists can now chain their vehicles to works of art. In Austin, Texas, there's a bike rack designed to look like giant steel grass blades that sprout from the concrete. In Portland, Oregon, there are two giant toothbrushes with steel dental floss stretched between them for bike parking. New York City riders parking on Wall Street chain their bicycles to a rack shaped like a dollar sign. Ken Herndon, who's in charge of sculptures as bike racks in Louisville, Kentucky, says all the installations have one thing in common, the 300-pound drunk moron rule. "We assume a 300-pound drunk moron will try to bend them," Herndon says. "They have to be built really well." I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the story of the only semi-pro basketball team in Prague that has included a U.S. player slash author. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Since the result of the presidential election became apparent late Tuesday night, all sorts of athletes have been celebrating that result, but some baseball agents have expressed concern over taxes their clients may have to pay. How do you think Barack Obama's presidency may change the sports landscape?
Well, I think that some baseball players are going to be paying a little more every April if their accountants aren't as clever as they might be, and I certainly don't have a problem with that. It was interesting watching the overall impact of this. I did not realize, for example, that LeBron James had worked quite as hard for the Obama ticket in Ohio as he did. He contributed $20,000. He campaigned for him. He was very outspoken afterwards. He talked about meeting him on the David Letterman show. And then, of course, we have the White Sox, who in 2005 invited him to throw out the first pitch and went on to win seven straight and the World Series, and have invited him to throw out 2009. I haven't looked at the schedule, but the complicating factor, of course, is there is a baseball team, allegedly a Major League Baseball team, playing in Washington now, and I think he sort of is obligated to go there.
If he's the president, he can do anything he wants with a schedule, can't he?
I suppose.
We've reached the halfway point of the National Football League season, Charlie. Would you have predicted that after eight games, the Tennessee Titans would be undefeated and the Detroit Lions would be, well, what's the opposite of undefeated? Just defeated?
The Lions, I believe. The Lions have been the opposite of undefeated for a long time. The biggest surprise in the NFL so far to me at the nine-week mark is the fact that Dallas can't beat anybody. I mean, this was a team that looked like an easy Super Bowl contender at the beginning of the year, and right now they're just awful. They're injured. They're sniping at each other. They're falling apart internally. The coach is not controlling the thing, and they're in one of the toughest divisions in football.
Quarterback Brady Quinn made his Cleveland debut on Thursday, played well in a losing effort, but I guess it's just not the year of the Brady.
No, he got him up to a lead, and then Denver came back, got 21 points in the fourth quarter, and beat him 34-30, which is interesting, of course, because Romeo Crennel, who is, I think, pretty much fallen off the hot seat and into the discard pile at this point, came to the Browns as a defensive specialist, and giving up 21 points in a quarter and giving up a lead at home is not what you expect him to do.
This week, USC head coach Pete Carroll became the most recent guy to criticize the bowl championship series system. Barack Obama criticized it as well. But come on, how many national titles has this guy's team won? Pete Carroll, come on. What does he have to complain about?
Well, not just complain about it. He understands full well how the BCS works. It works so well that he's become a famous college football coach playing by its rules. I'm sorry he might be the odd team out this year, but he'll get over it.
A duo of current Indians worked out for scouts in Tempe, Arizona this week, but they're not Cleveland Indians.
No, they are actual Indian baseball players, former cricket players, actually, from the subcontinent, coming out to try out for a reality show called The Million Dollar Arm, which drew 30,000 contestants. Now, as long as they don't have to run up to the mound to throw the ball, I think they're in great shape. Of course, reality TV has gotten into sports with The Contender, the
Absolutely.
Boxing show. And now we have this marvelous idea that we're going to go get people from India and bring them here and teach them how to throw a baseball.
And the result apparently was, with a couple of years in the minors, these guys might be ready for the
bigs.
Well,
if you've ever seen cricket, the guys throw the ball very hard. They just throw it in an odd way, and they're sort of allowed to bounce it if they want to, which you really can't do in the
end. Lots of major league pitchers do that, not on purpose, but... If Manny Ramirez wants to continue playing for the Los Angeles Dodgers, he can make almost $25 million a year doing so. What could possibly lead Mr. Ramirez to decline that offer?
The possibility of making $40 million a year somewhere else. His market is closing up a little bit, though. I mean, I don't know that... I mean, I suspect the Mets might make a try. I don't know if the Yankees will. And after that, there aren't many teams that can pay him more than this.
He also wants more years.
Yeah, he wants 4 years, which nobody will give him because at that point he will be past the point of breaking down. I have a feeling right now that he might wind up going back to the Dodgers.
For $25 million or $30 or $40 or whatever Manny Ramirez gets, the expectation would be that he would play. But I understand the New York Knicks will be paying Stephon Marbury about $22 million this year, and they don't necessarily have that expectation at all.
No, he is the sports equivalent of a cotton subsidy right now. They're paying him not to play, but more to the point, they're paying him not to play for them and not to go someplace else and play against them.
Mm-hmm.
Very funny, because Stephon Marbury is now looking back fondly to the coach he feuded with, Larry Brown, saying, gee, I wish he was here to yell at me again.
The big NBA trade of the young season was Allen Iverson to Detroit for Chauncey Billups and Antonio McDice. Do both teams benefit from this exchange?
I think Detroit will in a year when the contracts they traded for, including Iverson's, come off the books. They have a lot of money to bid for a terrific free agent class. I don't know what they're thinking, putting Rasheed Wallace and Allen Iverson on the same team for longer than half an hour. They're just asking for trouble. I do not envy the coach there at all.
Not so long ago, the best players on the European Pro Golf Tour all dreamed about crossing the ocean to play on the PGA Tour. Are you surprised that at least one very successful U.S. pro is talking about crossing the ocean in the opposite direction?
Not for Phil Mickelson. I mean, he's liable to do anything. I find it interesting that he's floating this rumor now just as Tiger Woods is coming back from that nasty knee surgery. I would not suggest cause and effect.
We've previously discussed lucky duffers who drop a couple of holes in one on a given day, Charlie, but what do you make of amateur golfer Kurt Hocker's recent achievements, plural?
Well, I hate him. I hate him with every fiber of my being. I hate him with the fury of 100 red-hot suns.
Mm-hmm.
5 holes-in-1 in a week, including 2 on the same day. And this year he's got 7 holes-in-1 and 2 double eagles. He can go away now.
And finally, Charlie, a scintillating new book that chronicles Britain's contributions to sports rule books also supports the argument that baseball originated in Britain. Prithee, what is author Julian Norridge's proof of that?
Well, he's going through a Jane Austen novel named Northanger Abbey, and you may note that my metabolism is slowing down just at the mention of Jane Austen and her novels. But actually, apparently Austen is referencing the sport in Northanger Abbey, where Catherine Morland, it was not very wonderful that Catherine, who had nothing heroic about her, should prefer cricket, baseball, riding on horseback, and running about the country at age of 14. 2 books.
Hmm.
So if you're willing to plumb the depths of Northanger Abbey and mow your brain when you're done, because moss will grow on it, then you can discover proof that perhaps baseball was an English game.
The letters we'll get from all the Jane Austen fans and all the people who enjoyed the masterpiece theaters made from her novels.
I'm sorry, Bill.
Charlie Pierce writes without pride or prejudice, except when he does have those things. For the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game, of course. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
If you'd like to read my reviews of books we've featured on Only a Game, or selectively listen to past features and interviews, please visit onlyagame.org. Having graduated from college in 1993 as an experienced parking lot attendant, disinclined to attend the law school that had accepted him, Dave Fromm decided he wanted to play semi-pro basketball in Prague. Among the curious aspects of this decision were Fromm's inability to speak or understand Czech and the fact that he didn't know if there were any semi-pro basketball teams in Prague. But he went anyway, and the result, more than a decade after the fact, is Expatriate Games, my season of misadventures in Czech semi-pro basketball. Dave Fromm joins me now from the studios of WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts. Dave, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
You had visited Prague before deciding to become a basketball player there. What made the city so attractive in the early and mid-90s?
Well, the first thing, I think, was really the price of beer. That was attractive to a fairly poor college graduate. It was a beautiful city that was full of people transitioning from all kinds of things, from a political and economic model to a new one. From a place in the East, or the East Bloc, to a place in Western Europe. And it was really appealing to a young guy like me who was looking to have an adventure and didn't have a tremendous amount of money and wanted to find a place to have the adventure.
Well, you decided early on that basketball should be part of the adventure. How did you go about trying to find a team for which you'd be able to play?
When I finished college, I took a look at my skill sets and decided pretty quickly that basketball was the only one that was really going to stand me in any good stead in the world. And I got to Prague and just began to walk around, literally walk around with my sneakers, trying to find anything, a gym, a hoop. And I was really lucky that some very kind people kind of took a look at me and realized that unless they helped out, I'd be lost forever. We found a cafe that had a banner hanging from the back wall, and the banner had a basketball on it. And we asked the cashier, you know, what is that? Where is that from? And she pointed on a map that I carried a map around all the time. She pointed on a map to an area of the city, and said that there was a team that played there. And so that night, I just went to that area and began, again, just walking around in the dark, listening for a basketball.
And it worked. You found a gym with a team playing, or at least a gym.
Yeah, it was a process. It was a process. I found the gym, and then I found an expatriate pickup league playing there on a certain night on Thursdays. That pickup game led to a scrimmage with a Czech team from a different part of the city. That scrimmage led to a very informal, almost joking offer to come back and play.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I took them up on the offer.
All right, this may be a sensitive question, but what exactly made your team semi-pro? Because you had to pay them to play, right?
That's right. I should begin by saying that my understanding of our place in the Czech basketball hierarchy was developed in a bar over beers by people who were speaking to me in Czech. So I was never exactly sure where we were. But there was a top league in the Czech Republic in the early 90s called the Super League. And at that level, I think some players, and I think maybe all players, got paid. I don't think that many of them were able to make a living on what they got paid, and many of them may have had full-time jobs or day jobs. And then there were various leagues beneath that that fed both players and teams upward. If you imagine arena football in the States, the league that I was in was probably double-A arena football.
The first half of the season was a disaster in terms of wins. In the second half, things improved. After one of the second half games, one of your teammates, Kracha, said to you, "The season was bad, but tonight it was good." What provoked that assessment?
We had played a team in the first half of the season that we had a lot of problems with. We had been arguing with them, and they beat us fairly convincingly. And they were considered one of the better teams in our league, and they showed up at our gym in the second half of the season. I don't quite know what happened to us, but we showed up, and it was like we were, it was like our best selves showed up, and we just whipped this team by about 35. And it gave us the sense that we could have been a very dangerous team. in some ways, maybe we were.
I'm tempted to say you could have been a very dangerous team if one guy hadn't kept whipping the ball off the wall and hitting the other guy in the belly with it or something like that.
That probably was one of the more effective aspects of our team, was that we were fairly relaxed. And frankly, you know, from my standpoint, I was very fortunate that I found a bunch of guys who didn't take the games too seriously, played hard, and were open to the idea of letting me play.
Did you know, even as this was going on, that you would one day write about it, albeit a decade and more later?
Yes and no. I kept a journal while I was there, writing in it at night after the games, with the idea that this was an important time in my life, or it was a transitional time in my life. Then I came home in July of 95 and started law school in August, and didn't really have the time or the talent, really, to do much polishing of the journal. Then about 10 years later, my wife and I began to think about starting our own family, and I thought I would take this thing out of the drawer and polish it up, with the idea that someday I could force, if we had our own children, someday I could force them to read it. And the irony of that is that I have a 6-month-old son, and the idea of him going off and doing something this reckless is terrifying to me. So I may have to keep this thing on the top shelf for a while.
Well, either that, we'll have to hope the book is out of print by the time he learns to read.
I was thinking on the way here that maybe I would just change the location of the adventure from Prague to Hartford or someplace
a
bit closer
to
home.
Des Moines, someplace
Des Moines.
Safe. Right.
Yep.
Anyway, at the end of the somewhat irregular regular season, your team endured what sounds like about the most uncomfortable road trip in basketball history. Tell us a little bit about that.
The de facto leader of our team was the incumbent point guard, a guy named Slava, who had what appeared to me at least to be shady connections. And Slava showed up late in the season and announced that he had arranged for us to play in an international basketball tournament in the south of France. I jumped at the chance because I loved the idea of crossing the border as a Czech basketball player, because within the borders of the country, I was an American on a Czech team. What I didn't know was that we'd be going by bus, and the bus didn't have a bathroom on it. The bus trip took 36 hours of driving. And I don't think it's actually that far. I can't quite figure it out.
It's not
today. I really don't understand what happened. We did stop a few times, and at one point the drivers got confused. They were on the Autobahn in Germany, and they took the wrong exit ramp. And they stopped in the middle of the exit ramp and began to back up. And I just thought, my God, this is where I'm going to die, in a Czech bus in Germany on my way to France.
Tell me, at what point during the basketball season in Prague did you realize that the winter of 94-95 would constitute the end of your basketball career?
You know, in a funny way, it didn't. I had gone to Prague to try and keep this basketball dream going and use it to have an adventure. And it worked. And I've been able to make most of my friends on a basketball court. My dad, who was my first basketball hero, and I still play together. In fact, we recently played against these two kids down in Western Massachusetts. And when the game was over, we played 2-on-2. And when the game was over, we did the math, and their combined age was 38, and our combined age was 100. but we whipped them, and I certainly hope that my basketball adventures will go on long enough that I can play with my own son.
Dave Fromm is the author of Expatriate Games, My Season of Misadventures in Czech Semi-Pro Basketball. It's published by Skyhorse. He joined me from WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts. Dave, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Bart Rankin at WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts, and from Erica Bailey. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Ken Shulman's cricket photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word is from Expatriate Games author Dave Fromm, who discusses his basketball uniform of 1994-95.
I still have the shorts that I wore that season, and I put them on recently. I thought it was a bad look 12 years ago. It hasn't improved at all.
Don't worry about it, Dave. I recently saw an NBA Classic game on TV, and your uniform looked much better than the NBA's short shorts of the 1980s. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.